This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Strange Harbor, online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird.
The strange, the unwashed, the uncaring, the unspecified.
Billy and Johnny here, and we talk about weird topics like UFOs and Sasquatch, other cryptozoology, near-death, afterlife. Bill died a couple times and has seen the other side. Did I say that right? Has seen?
I have seen it.
And according to you...
I saw it at the time, and I have seen it, so...
What is on the other side?
Well, the typical near-death, out-of-body, move to the other side experience tells us that you enter into a white light, where you're generally met by maybe somebody that you know, or a being that will guide you and take you into the other side, into the hereever after, I guess, the other dimension. Don't know what you really call it. I guess we call it heaven from a religious perspective. But it exists within the universe. It's an energy that exists in the universe. On my first near-death experience, I had a very typical one where I was badly injured in combat in Vietnam, and I had this experience where I went out of my body. I was in a dark tunnel, then entered into a bright white light. I met my grandfather there, who was going to be my guide. Basically, I was there for a relatively short time, and I was told by another being that came along, somebody obviously in authority, that I had to go back, that I couldn't stay there. But they also told me that I had a higher purpose to fulfill, that someday that I would come back there, and that whenever I went back into my body, that no matter what happened on that day, that I would live and live a long and productive life. And when I got back in my body, I was surrounded by the white light, and I then held a man in my arms while he died, and then was shot 5 times, and here I am.
That was a bad day.
It was a bad day, you know.
You died.
There are good days and bad days in combat.
You died, you come back, and then this guy dies in your arms, and then you get shot, and that is a bad day.
It's a bad
day. Any one of those things.
But, you know, here I am. It's been almost 50 years, and I'm still here. And
well, I'm glad you are.
Spreading the word and you know, trying to help people understand that there are things in this life that are important. Besides being the stewards of love and caring for one another, we're also the stewards of this planet.
Mm-hmm.
It's our job to take care of the planet, to make it habitable, to make it a place that we can live in and enjoy. We need to learn how to manage ourselves, manage our populations, manage our societies in a way that's peaceful, in a way that gives everyone an opportunity to live a happy and fulfilled and loving life.
Did you see where they're doing more logging right off the highway on your way here?
I see that. There were two big log trucks in front of me this morning, and with big fresh logs on them.
And, you know, I got to be clear on this. I have nothing against loggers, truckers, or any... I mean, you got to make a living.
Right.
You got to pay your bills.
Yeah.
I just think that we're smart enough to come up with alternatives now.
Sure.
To where instead of hauling, you know, trees, we could haul...
Hemp.
Hemp. Totally.
Hemp will replace everything that trees do for us.
Yeah, plus it grows faster.
And it grows faster, and... You know, it
produces more oxygen, or doesn't it break down carbon dioxide quicker?
Right, it breaks
quicker?
Down carbon dioxide and produces oxygen.
At a quicker rate, it grows faster.
It grows faster. It can be used in building materials.
Mm-hmm.
There are places that use hemp to build entire houses.
Yeah, and the oils and cooking.
Oils and cooking, almost everything that lumber can do, hemp can do. We have alternatives, but we have to look at those alternatives. What gets in the way of those alternatives is greed. Mm-hmm. There's big money in lumber because we don't explore alternatives. There's big money in oil because we don't explore alternatives. So this is a dangerous, dangerous thing. Cutting down the trees, we have alternatives to that. You know, it was a good idea before, but we don't have an abundance of trees.
And times have changed.
Those trees are important to our environment. They basically digest the carbon dioxide in the air. They expel oxygen. Okay, human beings cannot breathe carbon dioxide. It will kill you. It's toxic.
Mm-hmm.
We breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. But we can't do the opposite. We can't breathe in carbon dioxide and breathe out oxygen. One of the things I learned in my most recent near-death experience in talking to the spirits was that there's a balance, not just on this planet, but there's always a balance of nature. And when man upsets that balance, rather than working with the balance, then we have problems. Then it begins to destroy our environment, and it destroys our people. It destroys our health, our attitudes. It destroys a lot of things. We need to work for that balance. In the universe, there's a balance. And that's kind of what the spirit does. It works to maintain that balance. And there's a balance. There's even a balance between spirit world, the light energy of the universe, and the material world, the material of the universe. And there are other factors as well in the universe, but those are the two primary ones. It's our job, it's our responsibility to maintain the balance, to find that place where we can live well and get along with our environment.
It might be too late.
It might be.
It might be too late, according to a computer designed to predict the end of the world. Did you read about this yet?
I have not. I have not read about it.
A decades-old computer model predicting the end of the world, 2040. It's called the World One Program. It was created by a team of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in 73 to create a model of global sustainability. Instead, it predicted the end of civilized life as we know it by 2040, with an important milestone happening in 2020, only 2 years from now. The prediction says that a combination of increasing pollution and population will cause dramatic population loss. I'm reading this off of the Sputnik News website. If we do nothing about it, the quality of life goes down to zero. Pollution becomes so serious, it will start to kill people, which in turn will cause the population to diminish lower than it was in the 1900s. At this stage, around 2040 to 2050, civilized life as we know it on the planet will cease to exist. Worldmeters.com estimated the world population in 1900 to have been about 1.6 billion people. The site estimates 2018 world population to be 7.6 billion. By contrast, world population is expected to surpass 9 billion by 2040. Some of the model's predictions, like stagnating quality of life and diminishing availability of key natural resources, have already come true. Several others, computer models, have predicted a collapse of human civilization around the same time period. Weather events in the coming decades would put pressure on food and water resources. The issue of water scarcity, which is accelerating at such a pace that two-thirds of the world's population could live under water stress conditions by 2025. Volatile food prices and increasing political instability are likely to magnify the impacts of food production shocks, causing a cascade of economic, social, and political impacts across the globe. Did you get all that?
I did.
Okay, because it went in one and out the other.
I agree with it. You know, we're creating a climate that is anti-science.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to make things more profitable for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations that want to have a desperate employment pool where they can take people and put them to work for very little money,
mm-hmm.
Increase their profits. radically. Since the 1960s or even the 1950s, corporate wages have gone up over 900%. Profits have increased by over 700%, but wages have only gone up about 10%. We have to start creating a balance, not just the universe or the environment, but we have to create a balance with human beings. I have nothing against anybody making a profit on their business when that profit becomes unreasonable.
What's more important, profit or...
people.
Or staying alive.
Yeah. We put right now, in the United States, we put profits over people. The importance of making profits for the wealthy is far more important than taking care of the people. We are one of the only civilized nations that doesn't have free or inexpensive college education. We don't have universal health care. All these things other nations have, and it's working fine. There are countries that have had universal health care for 80 or 90 years. It works well, and they have no... there's never been any effort to get rid of it. Nobody has ever tried to get rid of universal health care once they have it. The same thing with college education. If we don't educate our people, we can't grow. And I know that education is a dirty word these days. There's lots of different ways to educate yourself. The advantage to college is that we can concentrate our studies, and we have access to greater resources than the average individual. In a college, you have access to, probably a dozen different professors, and you have books and resources, corporate resources, public resources, government resources, all that help us to learn about what's going on our planet. We need to find this balance, or we're all going to perish, and it won't be pretty. It's not like we're just going to go away one day.
Mm-hmm.
It will be decades of suffering as people die, as our health declines, as illness grows. We need to fight against this. I believe that we can still do this. I think that we have the knowledge, the technology, and the ingenuity to bring that balance back.
So who's going to do it?
Well, we have to do it. We as individuals have to do it. It's our job. That's what we're here for. Every individual has to contribute. It's not a government problem. It's not not somebody else's problem. It's your problem. It's each individual's problem. And it means being conscious of what you do. Stop buying water in plastic bottles. Stop using things that are environmentally unsound. Stop shopping with corporations that don't defend the ecology. One of the things that my wife and I did was we stopped shopping at Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And we started buying our groceries from local providers. So we go to the farmer's market and get our vegetables. We go to the local meat market and get our meat. We go to the local seafood place to get our seafood. Everything we need is right here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, occasionally we do go out of town to do some shopping, but there are things that we can't get here, but we do shop at socially responsible places. It's important that we all do this, that we all spend our money in a socially responsible way. Because if we don't, we're going to die a very unpleasant...
Well, that's happy.
I know. It's not a happy thought, but it's our responsibility. We are the dominant beings on this planet. And if we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it. There's no God that's going to come down and magically change things. We, as human beings, have to do it. We have been imbued with free will, even though we have a spiritual side. And we have guidance from spirits. But we don't use that guidance. I guarantee you that these big mega churches that bring in hundreds of millions of dollars, they're not tapping into your spiritual side. Mm-hmm. You know, they're abusing it.
On this whole computer predicting the end of civilization conspiracy, I don't know if this is related or not. You know this gluten epidemic, it seems like. Everybody's gluten intolerant.
Intolerant, yeah.
Well, I learned that our gluten levels, like in a loaf of bread here in America, is like 12 times the gluten as a loaf of bread in some other country. Because
Denmark.
Other countries don't let...
Right.
Other countries don't let them genetically modify things to do that, right?
Right.
So that's why people here are starting to have this gluten issue, because it's 12 times higher.
Right.
But if they were to go eat bread or pasta or whatever flour-based food some other country, they wouldn't have a problem at all because they're normal gluten levels.
Sure.
Does that sound right?
It does. And, you know, I like bread.
Why do we need to genetically modify our stuff?
We don't. That's just it. We don't.
So why are we doing it?
Because there's more profit in it.
Hey, hey, hey.
It's all about profit. It's all about making more money. Mm. We don't have to genetically modify food. We just need to grow it. We need to take care of the land. We need to rotate our crops. We need to do things that allow us to create and grow healthy foods. I like bread just as much as the next guy,
mm-hmm.
but I eat flourless, gluten-free bread.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds terrible, but it's not. it's got a little bit of honey in it, mm-hmm. so it's, you know, got that sweetness, and it tastes just like any other bread. In fact, it tastes a whole lot better, I think.
Is it because you have gluten issues?
No, I don't particularly have gluten issues, mm-hmm. because I don't eat a lot of... if you pardon the expression, crap.
Ah, right.
You know, I eat, even though I'm overweight, I eat fresh food, healthy food.
You would think that just your average loaf of bread would be somewhat healthy, right? You would think.
Well, if you look at the ingredients,
mm-hmm.
I went, last time I shopped at Walmart, which was a couple of years ago, I went through every loaf of bread, you know, every different brand,
mm-hmm.
on their shelf. And I looked at the sugar content. Every single loaf of bread in that store had a high sugar content.
Hmm.
We don't need sugar. We don't need refined sugar.
No, we don't.
So we can sweeten things with honey. We can sweeten things with other natural sweeteners.
Mm-hmm.
And honey is a sustainable resource. We need the bees. The bees help to maintain balance on our planet by pollinating flowers, and they produce honey. It's all a system of balances.
Now, it's my understanding that the bees aren't doing the pollinating they need to do because they don't like this genetically modified seed that we're providing.
They don't like the genetically modified stuff, and we're polluting our soil, so a lot of the plants that grow are full of pollutants. We're polluting our air, and that's killing off the bees. Every time we have these fires like we're currently having now,
mm-hmm.
It not only pollutes the air, but it burns off a lot of our vegetation that helps to keep our planet balanced. So this is kind of the beginning of the destruction.
The beginning of the end?
That Mother Nature is perpetrating on us because we've abused the planet to the point where nature seeks balance. So it's trying to balance things out, and it creates heat, which then creates dryness and fires. And
you know, I didn't really intend on this segment turning into like an environmental show or anything.
No.
I mean, and it almost feels like I've become an environmentalist. Not that I never really was.
This is the message of the universe. The universe is telling us this. The universe has told us this for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, you know, we're becoming environmentalists. We've always had to be environmentalists.
Okay, I gotcha.
This is part of our spiritual being. To be environmentalists, to be stewards of our planet, to take care of it, to nurture it, so that it does sustain life.
I remember what the spotted owl did to my family, my dad being a longshoreman.
Yeah.
It's like man versus environment. What's more important? Can't there be a harmony?
There can. And we can even still log off some trees, but we have to do it responsibly. This clear cutting is not good for the planet. So in our area, they've clear cut hundreds and hundreds of acres mm-hmm. of land in the last year and a half. Hundreds of acres.
Yeah.
Maybe thousands of acres. And they're doing it right now, right as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
They've just opened up a new area where they're logging everything off. I mean, just stripping the land bare. So what happens when they do that? Those trees not only digest carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, but they shield the Earth's surface, from the rays of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So once you take those those trees out,
yeah.
the sun beats right on the surface of the Earth. The Earth absorbs that heat and then releases it into the atmosphere. I live on sand, basically.
Mm-hmm.
My house is built on sand out at the beach. And when there's no real vegetation, there's some seagrass and stuff around, but no trees. So on a hot, sunny day, the sand heats up. And at night, even though it's cool outside, my house stays warm because then that heat is released
mm-hmm.
by the sand. And it comes up into my house, and it keeps my house warm. Same thing in the winter. If we have a clear day in the winter with the sun shining, I don't have to use my heat at night because it helps to heat the house through this process of releasing heat from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But that's normal in a sandy area. It's not normal in a wooded area.
Could this be another contributing factor to, bears in the city. It must be an overpopulation of bear or an overpopulation of wolves. They're running around the cities now. They're in town. They're in my backyard. There's an overpopulation. We need to go kill them. Or is it because we just took their habitat away?
We just cut down their home. They live in the woods. You know, when you cut down thousands of acres of trees, where are those animals going to live? We just keep pushing them more and more into the populated areas. We are our own worst enemy, and the message of the universe, the message that I got through my near-death experiences and through my travels in the universe, is that we have to take care of this planet. We have to be stewards of this planet.
Well, it's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and we've been talking about the weird, that crazy environment thing and the end of civilization as we know it. Coming up, I have some things to tell you about, Billy, if you want to move on in this conversation.
Sure.
The ancient Egyptian mummification recipe has been revealed. NASA may have found a wall at the edge of our solar system. A Canadian telescope picks up mysterious signal from deep space. Coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and, I'm still kind of recuperating from the first segment and how deep we went in this whole end of civilization and everything
right.
that's going on, and you know, some of the Bible people are saying, well, this is what it said in Revelation. All this stuff's going to, it's happening. But they've always said that with any bad kind of stuff going on.
Sure. I mean, the world was supposed to come to an end in 2000. It was supposed to come to an end, I think, in
2012.
Yeah. So, you know, and it didn't happen. And human beings are just so adaptable and they are so...
Greedy.
But we got to get rid of the greed and look at being resilient. We have to use our resilience in a positive way rather than a negative way. And I didn't mean to go that deep into that subject, but it really is the lesson that I learned in my near-death experience.
I'm really concerned. I am really worried. And I'm not generally a worrier in that kind of regard, but this, I'm worried.
Yeah.
Everything just, you know, mowing down everything and polluting everything and just all the greed, and it just doesn't seem like there's anything I can do to make it all stop.
And you know, I'm probably going to be able to live out the rest of my life, in relative good health and comfort. But I have an 8-year-old grandson.
Yeah.
Is he going to be able to live out his life and be healthy and functional? Is he going to live in a world that's comfortable for him?
Mm.
So what about this signal from space? What is it, a Canadian astronomy group? Or
Canada's new radio telescope called CHIME. It's short for Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. It's picked up some rather mysterious signals from deep space known as fast radio bursts, or FRBs, F-R-B-S. BS. Or FRBs, excuse me.
FRBs.
Now, the telescopes in British Columbia has detected the first ever FRB at frequencies below 700 megahertz, a signal researchers have named FRB 180725A. Now, FRBs, as the name suggests, are brief bursts of radio waves at super fast speeds of a few milliseconds and come from far beyond our Milky Way galaxy. Now, the phenomenon was first detected and reported in 07. As of mid-2017, only roughly 24 have been reported. Their origin, unknown. However, they're ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous.
Current best estimates suggest these events are arriving on Earth roughly 1,000 times per day over the entire sky. Now, the CHIME telescope's large collection area, wide bandwidth, and enormous field of view apparently make it a great detector of FRBs. Now, the CHIME FRB event rate is predicted to be between 2 and 50 FRBs per day. This high event rate promises major progress in examining this relatively new astrophysical phenomenon, according to CHIME scientists. Bright CHIME-discovered FRBs are found in real time and reported immediately to the worldwide astrophysical community for multi-wavelength follow-up. This is what happened with the detection of FRB 180725A. While it's very preliminary at this point, it was announced in an online astronomer's telegram post intended to encourage other astronomers to search for repeated bursts at all wavelengths. So far, only one FRB has been observed repeating, and researchers say whatever's sending that signal across the universe must be exceptionally powerful. Their indication also suggests they're not coming from known sources on Earth. In the meantime, CHIME and other similar observations will just keep listening, looking out for more clues to help solve the mystery of the super low FRB frequencies.
Well, this is fascinating because, you know, there certainly are other life forms in the universe. And there are certainly life forms that are far more advanced than we are. So it stands to reason that, you know, they would try to make contact with other life forms. And so I find this fascinating because I think if some other form of life or some other maybe human type life form is trying to make contact with us, or is even just randomly broadcasting to make contact with anybody, The fact that we can intercept those communications means that we may be able to contact them as well. We may be able to reply, because if we know where those contacts come from, we can then send our signal back in that direction in hopes of reaching them. Now, I don't know that we have the technology to send things faster than the speed of light, but even if we sent them at the speed of light, eventually, you know, we would have a response.
Now, What about Stephen Hawking's? Who's like, you know, we might not want to reach out to other potential civilizations in other parts of the universe, because if we only have ourselves to judge, they might not be friendly. We're not the friendliest. Look what we've done to each other and to, you know, other...
And to our planet.
Our planet and to each other and things that are different, other species of animals. What we do to those that we feel inferior to us, we enslave.
Yes.
So... if a more advanced race is out there, they're going to see us as what?
Slaves. To be used.
Mm-hmm.
If that's their proclivity. If they have grown and become more enlightened as they have advanced, then the more enlightened a life form is, the less likely it is to be violent or exploitive in its nature.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we are exploitive in our nature, but if we become enlightened, if we learn to communicate with the spirit and the energy of the universe, we learn that benevolence, love, kindness, goes much, much farther than violence and retribution and theft of someone else's resources and lives.
How about that hydrogen wall at the edge of our solar system?
Tell me about it.
Well, NASA scientists think their New Horizons spacecraft can see it. Now, the hydrogen wall is the outer boundary of our home system, the place where our sun's bubble of solar wind ends and where a mass of interstellar matter, too small to bust through that wind, builds up, pressing inward. Our host star's powerful jets of matter and energy flow outward for a long stretch after leaving the sun, far beyond the orbit of Pluto. But at a certain point, they peter out, and their ability to push back the bits of dust and other matter, the thin, mysterious stuff floating within our galaxy's walls, wanes. A visible boundary forms. On one side are the last vestiges of solar wind. On the other side, in the direction of the sun's movement through the galaxy, there's a buildup of interstellar matter, including hydrogen. Now NASA researchers are pretty sure that New Horizons, the probe that famously skimmed past Pluto in 2015,
yeah,
can see that boundary. You know, they've published papers on it. The researchers cautioned that signal isn't a sure sign that New Horizons has seen the hydrogen wall. Or that Voyager did. All three probes could have actually detected the ultraviolet light from some other source emanating from much deeper in the galaxy. New Horizons will continue to scan the sky for ultraviolet light twice a year and report what it sees back to Earth. Now, if the ultraviolet light drops off at some point, the New Horizons may have left the wall in its rearview mirror. But if the light never fades, then its source could be farther ahead, coming from somewhere deeper in space. Maybe where that signal's coming from. Huh?
Just
a lucky guess?
Just a lucky guess.
I am so dumb.
Well, you know, it makes sense that, I mean, there's essentially a beginning and an end to everything. So, the sun is basically a big chemical reaction. And, you know, it obviously gives off, lots of different things, light and light energy and, you know, the products of the chemical reactions that make it burn and make it hot. So, at some point, because they radiate out from the sun, there has to be an end. I mean, it dissipates at some point as it goes through the areas of space. So this, it just sounds reasonable to think that there is an edge to this. I don't know if I would call it a wall because it, you know, it makes me think of a barrier, but it, rather than, you know, the end of a process, you know, or the limit of a process, rather than the end of it. But, the whole thing makes sense to me.
Okay.
I'm not an astronomer. I'm not a, you know, I'm not an astrophysicist or anything, so I don't...
Are you sure?
I don't always understand all of that. I understand some of it, but...
Well, I probably didn't explain it all that great.
Of course you did. You explained it very, very well.
Right. You've been drinking again.
Yeah.
Life on other planets. I don't know if I pronounce this right. Enceladus. Enceladus? Enceladus.
Spell it.
Enceladus. Enceladus? Enceladus?
You got me.
Yeah, you got me too. It's one of the moons of Saturn. Having only a thin, scant atmosphere and no Earth-like surface features to suggest viability, it couldn't be more different from its fellow Saturnian moon, Titan. Its smooth surface is the result of gravitational interaction similar to Europa's, and also, like Europa, its icy crust hides a global subsurface ocean of liquid salt water. The interactions drive tectonic activity as well, causing a maze of rifts, grooves, and ridges across the surface. Most notably, they cause the powerful geysers in the southern polar region that actually create one of the rings of Saturn. So they're saying this place might be able... It's just like Earth.
Yeah.
Now, I had a theory. Okay?
Okay.
You want to hear it?
I want to hear it. Give it to me. Come on.
Let's say maybe Enceladus, however you pronounce this.
Yeah, Enceladus or something.
Let's say it's habitable. Say, maybe it's Earth-like. And Jupiter is made out of the same gases as the sun, from what I understand. So let's say when our sun burns out, we ignite Jupiter and then inhabit like Enceladus, which sounds like Earth, and then we'll have a little more time to maybe find another solar system to go to. Does that make sense?
Where we can make bigger profits.
Where we can make bigger profits, drill for oil, put up a Starbucks, and log.
Yeah, log it all off.
Hey.
But, yeah, it's, you know, back probably 30 or 40 years ago, there were some science fiction books that talked about some of the moons of Jupiter being manufactured rather than being of natural origin, and that they were actually satellites from other planets in the universe that were placed in orbit around Jupiter to give them a base of operations.
Who's they? To give them?
The aliens, the other life forms.
Gotcha.
That came so that they could monitor us or monitor our solar system.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any validity to that. I mean, it was science fiction, so it's hard to tell.
They haven't given you proof.
There was no proof or evidence. It was just speculation.
Okay.
But, it's something interesting to think about.
We'll get it, Billy. We'll get it.
We'll get it. We'll figure it all out. That's why we're here, right?
Yeah.
To figure out what's going on.
You know? Just wanna...
It takes time. You know, we all have to figure things out. And it takes time and effort and knowledge. And the more we take the time, you can't study every issue and every discipline in depth. So we have to pick and choose what we learn about. And so hopefully we'll have people that learn more about these things who have chosen to study them. And we'll find out what they are.
Have you had any strange things? I usually ask this at the beginning of the show, but have you had any strange things happen to you in the last week?
Not really. I haven't really seen those orbs in the sky again. But it was interesting that for one of our listeners who contacted us on the website had seen those red orbs right about the same time that I did. That's nice that it gives some credibility to that.
Yeah, because you're not a credible person.
No,
anyway.
Not at all. So, we have to keep our eyes open and look for these things. But in the last week or so, I have not seen anything that I would call unusual.
Okay.
I see strange things every day, but, that's just when I'm looking in the mirror. So, life is strange. Just this whole life, I feel blessed to have been able to live this life that I've lived, and it's unique and unusual, and each one of us is unique and unusual. Each one of us is special in our own way, and I think people forget that sometimes, and I think they feel like their life is meaningless, or that they have no place here, or that they haven't made their mark on the world, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we do. We all have a purpose. We all have a meaning. We all have value. And when we don't take that value to heart, we lose something. We lose something in our personalities and our ability to cope with life. Life is difficult. It doesn't matter who you are, if you're the wealthiest person on the planet or if you're the poorest person on the planet. Life is difficult for everybody in between and everybody at either end.
And according to some of the afterlife, near death, the reincarnated, if what they're saying is true, we chose to live. Does that make sense?
It does.
Do you remember the little boy who said, you know what happens when you die? And they were like, what? Well, you get to pick another belly and you come back and do it again.
Yeah.
So we chose to, I'm going to be Bill Vandenbush and live.
Yeah. Yeah. The spirit that inhabits my body chose me.
Mm-hmm.
It chose to be in my body, and it chose to assist me in this life. And I, as a human being, chose to allow it to assist me, I chose to consult with it, let it be a part of my life. And a lot of people don't do that. They shut that spirit out. They're almost afraid of it, because it might sound crazy or insane. And
mm-hmm.
We have to let go of that thing of being crazy and insane. We're all a little insane.
You are, not me.
Oh, well. Everybody I know except you. But, I worked in the mental health field for a long time, and one of the things that we always used to say is that normal is just a whole lot of weird averaged out.
Before we go, I wanted to tell you the mummification recipe.
Oh, yeah, we need to hear that. Tell us about it.
Well, they finally figured it out. A battery of forensic chemical tests carried out on a mummy that dated from 3700 to 3500 BC revealed the recipe, confirmed that it was developed far earlier and used more widely than previously thought. And scientists were like refusing to believe it while it was speculated. And they finally said, nope, it's boom. The Egyptian Museum in Turin, Italy, is new home of the mummy in question. Now, they've published this, so back off. This archaeologist says that this mummy literally embodies the embalming that was at the heart of Egyptian mummification for 4,000 years. They worked on this chemical fingerprint of every ingredient. Each element could have come from a number of sources. So here's the basic recipe. A plant oil. Possibly sesame oil.
Or hemp oil.
Yeah. A balsam-type plant or root extract that may have come from the bulrushes. A plant-based gum, a natural sugar that may have been extracted from acacia. Crucially, a conifer tree resin, which was probably pine resin. When mixed into the oil, that resin would have given it antibacterial properties, protecting the body from decay. Now, until now, we've only had a prehistoric mummy that was actually demonstrated so perfectly through the chemistry, the origins of what would become the iconic mummification that we would all know about. Now, I don't have enough time to go through how they figured it out or how they... You can find it. Just Google.
The
Google
alchemists, yeah. They had alchemists who were essentially people who studied drugs and
potions and
remedies.
Stuff, right?
Yeah. So
why does this matter, you say? You're like, so what? Who cares? The fact that this same recipe was used almost 2,000 years later to embalm the pharaohs means we have a sort of pan-Egyptian identity well before the formation of the world's first nation-state in 3100 BC. Its origins are much earlier than we thought. It also reveals an insight into how and when the ancient Egyptian perfected an antibacterial embalming recipe that protected and preserved their dead, leaving behind the iconic Egyptian mummies that we know now, right? Embalming was just one step in the careful process of preserving the body. The key steps of mummification: you remove the brain, typically out through the nasal cavity, is kind of gross, removal of the internal organs, putting the body in a natural salt to dry it out, coating the body with the embalming recipe to kill bacteria and to seal it, and then to wrap the body in linen. It was the drying and the embalming recipe that were key to the preservation, and it was the heart of their culture. You know?
And they were preserving those bodies because they felt that at some point they would be re-inhabited by a spirit, that they would essentially reincarnate.
I am just so fascinated with ancient Egypt.
It is. It's very fascinating. And I think it's interesting because they had technology that was well advanced of their time. Things that we have today sometimes aren't even as technologically advanced as what they had then.
And the Sumerians, you know, they were around before the Egyptians.
Right.
Did all these things that we still use today, but we're hardly taught anything about the Sumerians. I still don't know why. Anyway, should we wrap it up?
We should wrap.
You want to do it? You want me to do it?
So, this has been Strange Harbor. Thank you for listening, and stay strange.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.